it must be something that hits them pretty quickly, because the population out there are healthy, happy otters in Kachemak Bay.
An encouraging population survey of sea otters in Kachemak Bay. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 21st of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the long road to recovery for flood victims near Fairbanks.
You know, we're still at the point now where we're still pumping water out of basements and crawl spaces.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Great weekdays begin with the most up-to-date local news and information on APRN's Alaska Morning News. The Alaska Morning News, the news you wake up to.
A new survey shows the Kachemak Bay sea otter population has increased dramatically since 2002. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been paying close attention to the otters in recent years because hundreds in the area have died of a heart infection called valvular endocarditis. Biologists are still trying to figure out how the bacteria is infecting the otters. Verena Gill, a wildlife biologist for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, conducted the recent population survey. She hasn't crunched the final numbers, but she can already tell the population has increased significantly.
So I think we can comfortably say that since 2002, in the count of 900, that the otters in Kachemak Bay have doubled.
And what does this tell you? Overall, how healthy do you think the population is?
I think the population is extremely healthy. They're growing. And there's probably otters moving in, because I don't think they can double in that time frame without some migration into the bay. We did live capture last year, August 2007, and the animals that we caught were extremely healthy. Lots of fat, obviously a lot of food. Big, healthy animals. We screened them for disease. They didn't appear to have any. So the animals that are coming in with this bacteria, it must be something that hits them pretty quickly, because the population out there are healthy, happy otters in Kachemak Bay.
And so all of this sounds quite positive. Do you still have concerns about the population?
Well, we don't have concerns about the number per se, but we're still concerned about what they are dying from. We're definitely concerned about how they're getting this bacteria and how it may affect the population in the future. So the number that are dying is not unusual. It's what they are dying from that appears to be unusual, and we don't know the source of that.
Do you have any new leads or ideas on what may be causing this disease?
Sure. We are looking at different possibilities. We've looked at contaminants. We've looked at flame retardants, which are pretty ubiquitous in the marine environment. And that does not seem to be a problem. There are flame retardant residue in otters, but not at extremely high levels. So we've looked at a variety of different factors. And one of the things that we're focusing in on right now is a virus that could be suppressing their immune system and allowing bacteria to flourish.
And so, with all those factors, how big is the concern about this illness with the population overall? Do you think that they're going to continue to gain, or is it too early to know that?
Well, I think our concern right now is one of the things we're focusing on is morbillivirus, is what it's called, focine canine morbillivirus, otherwise known as distemper. Many pet owners probably have heard of distemper because their dogs get vaccinated for it. Well, in Europe, several years ago, there was a huge die-off of gray seals and harbor seals from focine distemper, and we've never had it documented in the Pacific. And we have actually isolated focine distemper from sea otters in Kachemak Bay, and so we are extremely concerned that this could adversely affect the population all over the state. I don't want to jump to any conclusions because it may not. They may just carry the virus, and this may be nothing to do with it. We're looking at if this virus is suppressing their immune system and allowing bacteria that may otherwise be in them to flourish.
What does this new count mean for the unusual mortality event designation?
Well, we're going to have to analyze our data a little bit more, look at the two distribution counts, analyze the numbers from the population count in May, and then look at the 7 criteria there are to declare a UME and see if we still fit that criteria. One of them is an unusual amount of animals dying. We certainly don't appear to have that because normally you can expect about 10% of a population to die annually. So if you have 1,000 otters, you'd expect 100 to die each year. Even if the UME is no longer in operation, it doesn't mean we're going to stop the investigation. We're continuing the investigation and putting the same amount of effort into it.
Farina Gill is a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Gill asks that the Seward Sea Life Center be notified if you find a dead or injured sea otter. More information and pictures are on our website, aprn.org. Areas hit hard by flooding earlier this month are still struggling to recover. The highest water on the Tanana River in 41 years flooded homes in parts of Salcha and Fairbanks and Nenana, where nearly the entire town was inundated. Nenana Mayor Jason Mayran says the flood has taken its toll on local people.
For probably 3 weeks there, we went 10, 12, 14-hour days, 7 days a week until we got a real good handle on things. And just the last 4 or 5 days, folks have been back to relatively normal schedules.
Mayran says Nenana's roads are largely passable again, but that recent rains have kept water from fully receding.
We're still at the point now where we're still pumping water out of basements and crawl spaces. The ground got saturated during that flood event, and the water has just got no place to go right now. It takes a couple of weeks for the water table to drop back down once the river goes down. It's got a little bit of a lag behind it. So there's still a lot of standing water, especially in the low areas, but it is going down a little bit every day.
Mayran says many Nenana residents are busy cleaning up and repairing their homes. The state is helping to cover the cost. The Division of Emergency Services reports that 189 individuals have applied for assistance, most in the interior. 39 people have been provided temporary housing. Mayor Mayran says one of the major problems facing the community is silt that entered the city septic system with floodwater. He says it's been tough on pumps and other components.
We managed to get everything kind of running, but they're tentatively running. We're not sure how long they're going to last.
Mayrand estimates damage to Nenana public infrastructure, including the septic system, roads, and public buildings at between $2 and $3 million. Affected structures include Nenana's cultural and civic centers, the city offices, police department, and dock buildings. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, major renovations for some village public safety officer buildings.
Some offices were like 16 by 16. Their desk is exposed to where the jail cell is right there. The confidentiality wasn't really there.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
The two Democrats running for Alaska's lone seat in the U.S. House of Representatives are already setting their sights on Washington. Incumbent Republican Don Young's ethics troubles have left him vulnerable, and both Ethan Berkowitz and Diane Benson believe they can defeat either him or whichever of his opponents might win the Republican primary. APRN's Steve Heimel has a look at the two candidates.
In the whirlwind that is the final week of the primary campaign, Ethan Berkowitz is leaning forward toward the finish line, rushing around the state, shoring up votes. Diane Benson, on the other hand, while certainly keyed up, also seems more at home with the network of old-timers, veterans, natives, and progressives who have decided to back her. Both have run for statewide office before, Berkowitz for lieutenant governor and Benson against Don Young 2 years ago.
I ran once against Don Young and surprised everyone who came before me with money and with party support and all of it going for them, and still outdid them. Many of them weren't taking me seriously, but the people did, because the people really want something different.
Not much separates the two candidates on the issues. Both support the draft Democratic platform plank calling for universal health care coverage. Both support drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Benson is trying to make an issue out of Berkowitz's larger money resources, some $630,000 compared to her $200,000, calling on him to pledge not to accept donations from political action committees. Berkowitz doesn't believe his integrity is questionable.
And she's done a good job making ethics a cornerstone of her campaign. I've made it a cornerstone of mine. There are different ways to be ethical. And she's chosen one path, I've chosen another. And if you, all you need to do is look at my record. I've stood up for the right thing time and time again. And I have a proven track record of standing up for the right thing. And I will always stand up for Alaska's best interest. That's who I am, and that's what I think is important.
He says he's the better candidate because of his proven experience.
The track record I established when I was the voice of the minority in Juneau is going to help me significantly. I know how to stand up against tough odds, and I know how to make things happen without putting my name on them.
Both candidates say they will stand up for full benefits for veterans returning from combat duty with consequences.
I think America and Alaska owes our veterans a tremendous amount, and I will stand up and advocate for them as powerfully as I possibly can.
Diane Benson says she's like a dog with a bone about veterans. It's well known that her son, Latsin, lost both his legs while serving in Iraq in 2005. He's since become a leader in disabled athletics, most recently adding scuba diving to his sports.
So he proves that life can go on. And I think that's one of the strengths of my own family, from going back to my great-great-grandmother's, that can-do attitude of no matter what happens, you go forward. And our state is in a critical situation right now. We all have to go forward.
It's a tall order to advocate for Alaska when you're only one voice among 435 in the House. But both Democratic candidates are confident they could be effective. Benson made a trip to D.C. not long ago and found the Democratic leadership highly sympathetic.
I think they love it that I was a dog musher and and that my son did the things that he did, that I drove trucks on the pipeline. It gets their attention. Even though they're members of Congress, they are still people. They get fascinated by these stories, and that's one way to hook them in and say, this is what the reality really is for Alaska, and this is what we need.
Somewhat similarly, Ethan Berkowitz says he can help Alaska sell itself.
What I bring are the resources that Alaska has, and I bring the conviction that this state has a lot to offer this country, and I am convinced that when America sees all that Alaska is and all that Alaska has to offer, it's going to give us more of a role to play in the country's energy security, and they'll be much more attentive to the issues we're raising.
Both Berkowitz and Benson list energy as their top priority. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The state's predator control program would be changed if on Tuesday voters approve ballot measure 2. The initiative is the latest in the back-and-forth battle between urban and rural views of big game. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The initiative sets tighter limits on when the state can use airplanes to kill wolves and bears that are threatening game populations. Currently, airborne events are part of ongoing predator control programs. Under the initiative, however, the Commissioner of Fish and Game must determine that the game population faces a biological emergency before airplanes can actively take part. Joel Bennett is one of the sponsors. He says the initiative leaves the commissioner a lot of flexibility in determining whether a biological emergency exists.
The biological emergency is defined not as our opposition is saying, but as we say, a situation which, if not corrected, will lead to an irreversible decline. It doesn't have to be an irreversible decline. And so it can happen long before the dire situation. But he has to make findings that what's going on is leading to a situation that's going to become an irreversible decline if they don't do something.
Bennett says the initiative will not affect ongoing predator control programs. It will only reserve the use of aviation until it's needed. Opponents want airborne shooting and land and kill programs in the complete package of ongoing weapons the department can use. Bethel Democrat Mary Nelson says that's because airborne same-day predator control is effective. She says moose populations have dropped drastically every time it's been taken away.
The predators are so good at killing the ungulates. They have to be controlled. The other tools in the toolbox are not as effective. This is the most effective, the most humane way, really, to deal with predators.
Bennett says that true open-ended wolf hunting is still forbidden statewide. But he sees the existence of the airborne program as primarily a benefit to hunters.
It is more limited than it used to be, but it still covers six areas now over 60,000 square miles of Alaska, which constitutes the heart of the game country. However, we have now, part of our problem with the current program is that most of the old wolf hunters that were involved in the freewheeling days are now the permittees doing the wolf control for the department.
Rural Alaskans argue that it's not about sport hunting. It's about subsistence. Nelson says the limited areas where the measures are in place are also the most rural, most economically depressed parts of the state, where meat is very expensive, if it's even available at local markets. And Gregory Rositska with the ONC Native Corporation in Bethel told the Anchorage Assembly earlier this month that the connection was most obvious when airborne control programs were banned.
Since those 96 initiatives passed, and then followed by the one in 2000, our subsistence hunts have been shut down entirely or are very, very limited tier two. The amounts necessary subsistence that are established in regulation are not being met.
Nelson says the initiative will be felt most by natives living in rural Alaska. She says moose and caribou should be managed for maximum yield for everyone, like other resources. Bennett says the initiative does no harm to predator control programs where they are appropriate. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The Alaska Public Offices Commission has dismissed a complaint filed against the state of Alaska related to the education materials they have released outlining the state's predator control program. KBBI's Mike Mason has the story.
The complaint was filed on August 14th by the Alaska Wildlife Alliance, which is supporting ballot measure number 2 to further restrict the use of aerial hunting to control predators like wolves and bears. The complaint covered the materials the state has been producing, including the flyers released in early August. The Alaska Wildlife Alliance believes the state spent public funds to influence the outcome of next week's vote on ballot measure number 2. However, the Alaska Public Offices Commission ruled that the money was appropriated for the purpose of educating the public about Board of Game programs, including predator management. Valerie Brown is the Anchorage attorney hired by the Alaska Wildlife Alliance to pursue the APOC complaint. She says the commission found the timing of the flyers suspect.
But then they made a really narrow interpretation of the law about what is educational and what is nonpartisan and decided because the material doesn't say vote no on 2, that it was allowable.
In March of 2005, the Alaska Board of Game passed a resolution in support of a public education program on predator control, and they asked for an appropriation from the state legislature. The legislature approved funding in the amount of $400,000 effective in July of last year. However, a fish and game official testified that only about $150,000 has been spent thus far. Brown says the APOC ruling sets a bad precedent.
I think it's going to open it up for the state to be much more aggressive about the information they put out.
In their ruling, the Public Offices Commission concluded that the Department of Fish and Game had a directive from the state legislature to develop an educational program, including predator control. The commission further noted that in the booklets, brochures, and public radio ads, there was no express discussion of ballot measure number 2. Tim Berry is the communications director for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
The Board of Game did deliberately, in an effort it's been engaged in for about 6 or 8 months now, want to try to get some of the educational materials that our department has put together over the past few years out in advance of the election, knowing that there would be, you know, increased public discussion on these matters and wanting to make sure that we got some factual materials to people.
In their ruling that was released on Wednesday, the Public Offices Commission noted that while the timing of the publications appears to be suspect, the commission finds that the Alaska Wildlife Alliance did not prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the Alaska Department of Fish and Game intended to influence the outcome of an election. In Homer, I'm Mike Mason.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
An agreement between the Forest Service and two environmental groups has cleared the way for a timber sale on Southeast's Chichagof Island. Those involved expect the logs will go to a small, locally owned mill in Hoonah. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Parties to the agreement say the sale will allow Hoonah's Icy Straits Lumber to take about 2 million board feet of timber a year for several years. Sue Tyler of Icy Straits says that's about twice what it uses now and would allow for some expansion.
We've been striving to, you know, supply a finished Alaskan product to the local building community here in Hoonah and the surrounding areas in Juneau, Sitka. So what it does, it keeps us operating.
The Forest Service planned to sell 40 to 45 million board feet of timber through the Iyugtug sale. That's enough to build about 4,000 two-bedroom homes. But environmental groups appealed and threatened to tie up the sale in court. Two of the groups agreed to stop blocking about a quarter of the sale as long as the trees would be offered to Icy Straits. Russell Heath of the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council says the remainder of the sale includes valuable fish, deer, and bear habitat, and would require a much larger operation than Icy Straits, possibly from the lower 48.
Approximately three-quarters of the sale was not designed for local use. It was designed for a much bigger operator. And we made it very clear to the Forest Service that we did not want to increase the capacity of the industry on the forest, particularly if timber cutters or timber operators came from outside, that we were interested in supporting the local industry but not increasing the size of the industry.
The Forest Service agreed to push back plans to sell the rest of the timber. Those areas would have involved helicopter logging and cuts in roadless areas. But the agency's Forest Coal says it could still be sold sometime in the future.
Obviously, the amount of wood that we've cleared with a sale is more than what's immediately necessary for Icy Straits, but it could present a potential long-term wood supply that would help both Icy Straits in the long term and others if the need arises.
Mills in Klawock, Wrangell, and Ketchikan have said they're badly in need of more timber, though SEAC says it will likely take its objections to court if the Forest Service tries to put the rest of the trees on the market. The Sitka Conservation Society was also part of the agreement. Terms also include a Forest Service commitment to thin some dense second-growth timber to make it better for wildlife. Cole says the first phase of the timber sale could be offered up early next year. Logging could start next summer. The Forest Service and SEAC credited a two-year effort to reach common ground on Tongass issues. SEAC's Heath says the Tongass Futures Roundtable set the stage for the agreement.
What the roundtable and some of our other work on the forest has done is just change the atmosphere and deepen the relationships between all the different stakeholders. So it was a lot easier for us to sit down and talk to the Forest Service, say, these are our concerns. And then the Forest Service could put their concerns on the table. And then Wes Tyler, the owner of Icy Straits Lumber, could put his concerns on the table. And we kind of shuffled everything and found where the common ground is.
SEAC and the Forest Service hope their agreement resolves conflicts over the timber sale to Icy Straits, but two other appeals are still outstanding. The Ketchikan-based Tongass Conservation Society filed one. Greenpeace filed another in partnership with the Sierra Club, the Cascadia Wildlands Project, and a Hoonah resident. Either could tie up the sale by taking their appeal to court. Larry Edwards, a Greenpeace staffer in Sitka, says the group has not decided whether it will take further action. Tongass Conservation could not be reached for immediate comment. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Renovations have been underway to several village public safety officer buildings in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. As KYUK's Alice Griswell reports, the newer buildings are already having a positive impact on one of the region's toughest jobs.
Village public safety officers are often the first responders to crimes in communities that are off the road system. Whatever they might be, there is a high burnout rate in the field. John Friendly started this challenging job in the village of Eek nearly 2 years ago, and it is not until recently that he has felt safe in the building he is working out of.
The first building I moved into was 20 years old, so the building in there was unstable. It was rotting. You know, the foundation was rotting and the walls were caving. The ceiling was not so good. The building would leak.
He says the floor of the building was sinking in, and the door to the outside did not shut properly. He says it was a hazardous place to work in. But last year, things started to change. Through state-funded renovations, Eek's public safety building started to get a makeover, which included secure jail cells and offices that now have doors.
Now, when I come to work and I see my new public safety building that's been renovated, it makes me feel good that I'm working in a good working environment, good building.
The village of Eek is just one of 14 villages seeing renovations on their public safety buildings in the YK Delta. The state awarded $520,000 to the Native nonprofit, the Association of Village Council Presidents, or AVCP, which runs the region's VPSO program. Alvin Jimmy, the region's VPSO coordinator, says the village of Kangigunuk had the worst building in the region for many years.
Some offices were like 16 by 16. Their desk is exposed to where the jail cell is right there. The confidentiality wasn't really there. In winter times, cells themselves were cold.
Jimmy says there has been a positive reaction from the region's VPSOs and the village's tribal councils. He says they are showing more support for their local public safety programs.
They're proud of it, and all of them are, those 14 villages are making their efforts to fix up those facilities.
The VPSO renovation projects were different than other construction projects in the villages because local community members did the work themselves instead of the usual outside contractors. Andy Stemp is AVCP's Vice President of Finance. He says they have struggled for many years to find the funding necessary for the building improvements. He says the changes are not just about physical environment, but really the improved morale it promotes.
It's a question about coming to work every day when you're an officer and seeing a nice door on a facility where there's pride involved, people are taking care of it. It's a really great project. The community gets a nice facility. It shows a lot of respect for public safety in the villages.
The improvements to the village public safety buildings have also given volunteer search and rescue groups in the YK Delta a place to meet. In Bethel, I'm Alice Criswell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We'd love to hear your comments about the show. To send us your thoughts, go to APRN.org, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and click on the Contact Us link. Be sure to let us know if we can use your comments on the air, and if so, how to pronounce your name. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Mike Mason in Homer, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Alice Criswell in Bethel. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Eli Menneker. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org. APRN would like to thank the Alaska Railroad Corporation for sponsoring Alaska Morning News and Alaska News Nightly. To learn more about this sponsorship, call 907-550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.